There are times when we come to points in our lives when we want to say, what's the use? We look around us, and much like the writer of Ecclesiastes, we notice that things are really a mess, that there is oppression, that there is loneliness, that there is envy, there is greed. There are all the things that really can ruin the value of our work, of our efforts, of our labors. And there are times, especially as Christians, because we have perhaps a keener eye for sin than the unbeliever, it's easy to look around us and say, what's the use? Let's give up. Why should we keep on going? And it's not that any of us actually decide to quit, but that's often our feeling. And it's an understandable feeling because we live in a fallen world. We live in a world which we've seen, according to the book of Ecclesiastes, is full of vanity. That is to say that it is out of whack. It is not according to the way that God has designed it to be. And so things go awry. They don't go according to the way they should go. And people do things not according to the way they were designed to do them for the glory of God, but rather they do them for their own glory, out of envy for their neighbor, oppressing the weak and poor. And that's the way the world tends to go. And so we have looked at cycle one, and we have seen that both work and wisdom seem to come to the end of frustration. And now we enter into cycles two and three, which make up the whole of the book. And what he does is the writer takes work and then wisdom. So we've looked at the whole. He said many things there, and now he's going to unpack them in more detail in terms of work in cycle two, and then in cycle three, he will look at wisdom. And he's going to be working, constantly working to get us to see the world the way it really is. This is not some fiction. It's not a hypothetical world. It's the way the world really is, out of whack because of sin, because of the fall. It's not functioning according to design. And he wants us to analyze this, to observe, to look, to see, and to understand that there is good in life and there is bad in life. There is suffering, but there is also joy. But that these are both relative in terms of their endurance, and that they are both pointing us to a greater good, which is actually the person of God himself. Now, in this third or this second cycle, where we look now at the whole business of work, of our endeavors in life, and work here is not just our 40-hour job, but all of our activities, really, as human beings, we divide this up into seven panels or sections. And it's helpful to look at it in terms of panels, because as you lay these out, and I've done this, I've got charts and diagrams and all kinds of stuff, you can actually compare them, and you can see that they're both, all the panels, all seven, are heading towards a central panel. Yes, it's a chiasm. And at the center, because that's the way most Hebrew and ancient literature was structured for the sake of remembering it. So right at the center of it, we're going to see, and this is the center of the book, because you've got one and three, this is cycle two, and at the center of the center panel, picture a big screen with beautiful pictures on them, and at the center panel, number four, we've got verses 5, 1 through 7, or 1 through 6, and this is going to be the main point of Ecclesiastes. So that's where we're headed. Now, we looked at the panel last week. We looked at panels 1 and 2. This week, we're looking at panels 3 and 4, and it maybe you could say it's all of chapter 4. I'm picking verse 22 out of the last chapter and adding that to it because I see this repetition of the word better. But that might be a fielder's choice or a preacher's choice. But the point here is really very clear that he's saying, now you look at this, you see work, you see activities, it's easy to get cynical about it. because we see the corruption of it. But hold on. Don't jump to conclusions. It's one of the main lessons of the book of Ecclesiastes. Don't jump to conclusions. Take the wisdom of God, and I want you to now look at things. Notice how many times he uses the word saw there. And then I turned, and by the way, I don't know why English translations do this, because it doesn't help the preacher, but when I turned verse 1 of chapter 4 and considered. It's the same word saw that you see there, that you see again in verse 4. Again, I saw, same exact Hebrew word. Verse 7, I saw. Okay, it keeps occurring. It's a repetition all there throughout the book. Throughout the panel, or two panels. Then you're going to see that you see the word better keeps being repeated. And what you have here is within this panel, you also have a chiasm. Verse 7 is the center of it. And notice that there is no, the word better doesn't occur there. And before it, there are two panels that have better at the end of the panel, three verses, 1-3, then 4-6, it ends with better. And then if you look at 8, and I'm dividing it differently than the New King James, 8-12, better then occurs at the end of this little piece. And then finally 13-16, better occurs at the end there. At the beginning there. So what you have is, you have 1-3, the word better. 4-6, the word better. 7 is the center. Then you have 8-12, and better begins it now. And then the final section, 13-16, better begins it. There's a pattern. And this is now what we are to learn from this pattern that the writer has so skillfully crafted for us. Better not to exist. This is a better with a downside. A better not to exist than to be oppressed. He looks at work. He looks at the activity of men. He's observing carefully what goes on. And he sees that most people, are used for the gain of others. And you may not be a slave, but if you're employed by someone, you may, in some way, you're certainly working for the gain of someone else. And we've all perhaps worked at different times for people who became quite rich through our labor. And of course, that's a legitimate thing within bounds. But what the writer of Ecclesiastes realizes is that there's a tremendous temptation out there to exploit. And in the ancient world, there was slavery. And in the present world, there is slavery. There are people who are exploited daily. They are used, plain and simple. They are thrown on the scrap heap of history. They are garbage. They are junk in the eyes of their oppressors. We have it easy. The worst job I've ever had looks like liberty, freedom, and prosperity to many of the people in the world in which we live. And so the writer's looking around and he says, power enables the strong to oppress the weak. A few people have power and wealth, and most people are in a position that are open to oppression. They are susceptible to oppression. And the worst part of it all is that they have no comforter, he says. No comforter in verse 1. They are left without any comfort in this world. We think there's oppression. People will say to us, they'll throw that in our face. They'll say, look at all the horrible things that are happening. Abandoned people. We have right here in the United States of America, young people who wander off from home because they have no real love. They especially often don't know anything about a father that truly loves and cares about them. And they end up being sold into slavery. This is going on while we speak in our nation with hundreds and thousands of young people. And it's going on all over the world. There is oppression, and there are some people who have no comforter. No one cares anything about them, whether they live or die. And it is the kind of thing that has often moved the hearts of people to go out and spread the gospel and to spread it with good deeds, which demonstrate the love of God and what true human fatherhood and loving care of fathers and mothers can provide for the abandoned. Now he looks out and he sees a whole world full of this kind of awful oppression. And of course we know that the Bible, that because the Lord does, has tremendous sympathy with the fatherless and the widow, with the orphan and the widow. And so we have the writer Q is looking out at the world and he says, with all this work, a lot of work is the activity of people getting rich off the backs of the poor, off the backs of the oppressed, and there is no justice. And so work is terribly imperfect. It's terribly imperfect. It's out of whack. It's not the way that it was designed, the way that it looks under the sun. It would be better for people to be dead, and then even better if they were never born to begin with. This is how oppressive the work world, which Q observed, really is. It's a perversion of the design for which he designed work, wealth, power. All of these are contradictory to life itself. Life, you'd be better off without them. If this is your life, you're better off not to live. Proverbs 14:31 says this, he who oppresses the poor reproaches his maker. It's contrary to the very nature of God. What a world. Can we possibly be happy in such a world? Can we find any peace and contentment? Well, yes, actually, he then goes on to say that. So you see, be careful. The message is not only that we need to be concerned about the poor and the needy, the fatherless and the widow, those without a comforter, but the real message here is that in such a world where we might be tempted to become cynical, there is another kind of better, not the better of not existing, but the better of a little peace, a handful of peace in a world that is trying to grab after wealth with two hands, two-fisted, grabbing and grasping. And so better a little peace than a lot with envy. And it's an interesting here. If you look in verse 4 now, if you have the New King, English Standard Version, you'll have a different translation. This translation says, I saw, he's observing, that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. Or English Standard Version says something like that his work is motivated by envying his neighbor. And you know what? It doesn't matter. Because what he's saying is that so much of work is motivated by envy. We want to get ahead. We want to be better than our neighbor. And if we're honest, even here in America, surely this ends up being the motive of so many in the workplace. And this is something we can perhaps even more closely identify than with the idea of oppression, because it's something that anyone who's worked out there in the world for very long has seen it. And if you've looked honestly in the mirror, you've realized that it's a temptation for you too. We're constantly being filled with the idea that we owe it to ourselves to buy A, B, C, and D, to spend lots of money, to lavish ourselves with all kinds of comforts and efficiencies and luxuries. And in order to do that, you have got to get ahead. And so envy drives work. And what the writer of Proverbs says is that envy is a rottenness to the bones, that envy kills the human spirit. It does not bring health. Again, it is contrary to the way God made us, to envy, to have that be the driving force of work. But when we have no love of God, then that's really ends up being one of the only motives left. And he says it isn't the way it should be. It's vanity, and notice that he says it's grasping after wind. And so he's really saying that this two-fisted grabbing after gain is just futile for many reasons, because you can't take it with you, but it also ends up working much ill in people's lives. And so the writer then here very skillfully says, but a handful of rest in verse 6, that is better than two hands loaded with gain that comes from the striving of envy, motivated and moved by envy. And incidentally, in the middle, he makes the statement in verse 5 that the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. So also, there's the other end, the person who just sits back, and instead of grasping out of envy, he sits there and goes like this, and he falls asleep. And Proverbs talks about that in a couple places, chapter 4 and I think 30, where it says that the person who folds his hands becomes then the poor man, and his poverty eats him up. And here it's saying that, metaphorically, of course, that he ends up having to eat his own flesh because he is not earning any money. And so the writer is saying, but there is a better way, and this is the way of the believer. The way of the believer is that a handful of tranquility, that is to say, to be content with what God provides through your everyday work, not to be motivated by envy, but to work in order, as Paul says in Ephesians 4, to give to others. Interesting how he says that to the thief. He says, let him work with his hands. Let him pay back the person that he stole from. That's out of envy. And now let him work with his hands, not just so that he can provide for himself, but so he can give to others. So this one hand, in a sense, is there to provide for his own needs, and the other is open to the needs of those around him. And so then the writer moves on, and in verse 7 comes to the center now of this panel and says, here there is no better, work is out of whack. That's the statement. It's a very plain one. And then I returned, and under the sun, what did he see? He saw vanity. And remember that phrase, under the sun? It's interesting that the commentators look at this as just being sort of like the horizontal view. But remember we said at the very beginning, it's much more than that. That under the sun in the ancient world meant to be under the view of heaven. And remember the Egyptians, for example, believed the sun was God. And that it was hot, and therefore there was judgment, there was justice represented in the sun. And we know as Christians that the sun simply is part of God's creation, but it certainly represents, it is a revealing of him and his nature as the judge. And we know that under the sun, that under heaven, that under God's presence and observation, that in our sin we are under his wrath and condemnation. And so it's far more than just the horizontal view. It's a world that's out of whack because of sin. And what's amazing is that, as it were, holding as a kind of theme that runs through all of the difficulties of life is this presence of God's goodness, of his blessing, in spite of sin, in order to keep history moving and keep history going so that his redemptive purposes can be worked out for all eternity. And so we see then the betters. There is a better, two betters, two sections, 1 to 3, 4 to 6, on one side of this theme verse. And then there are other betters on the other side of it, two more betters. And what he's really pointing us to is he's saying the betters are not the best. And so he's giving us a hint that there's something better than better. There is a best. There's something else to aspire to. There's something beyond the sun. And then he goes back. He's giving us a hint. He's teaching us to long for more because of what he's observing in the created order that's so out of whack. So then he picks up the second two panels just to convince us that there's a better, so we don't despair in this life. But then he brings us ultimately to consider the best. And so then the fourth thing would be, verses 8 through 12, better work with others than to be alone. Some have put 8 with 7, but I prefer to put this with 12 because the theme is very clear that in 8 he says that there's a certain kind of person, a loner, who lives for himself, and he works constantly, working, 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 grabbing after wealth, trying to get ahead. There's no end to his labor, but he's never satisfied with his riches, and he never stops to ask this most fundamental question, who? Interesting, not what, but who am I doing this for? Who? He's talking about the need of human community, and that's why he goes on and unpacks the importance of human community in verses 9 through 12. And he's saying, this is one of the great blessings in a fallen world, is that when we learn that we're not here to live for ourselves. And in fact, ultimately, we're here to live for God, to love God. And flowing from that comes a love for our neighbor, which broadly means everyone that we're connected to, in the family, in the church, in our neighborhood, in our community. And so, working for yourself, says the writer, is, and this, notice this word, this is vanity, so it's not the way it was meant to be. We're not meant to work for ourselves, but it's a grave misfortune. That's a wonderful word. Think about the word misfortune. It means a missed fortune. It's a fortune that we didn't find. It's riches that we missed. And what is the riches that we missed? Well, the writer doesn't leave this to our imaginations. He says, two are better than one. So that's the third better. Two are better than one. Human companionship is a better. It's not ultimate, but it is a good blessing in this life. So again, should we be cynical? Hold on, don't come to quick conclusions just because we see greed and envy and oppression, but come to the right conclusion that in the midst of this, God is still blessing. He's still giving us some of His goodness to spur us on and to ask, in the case of both the evil and the good that is present under the sun, what is the best? Is there something more? Is there someone else beyond even community with all of its goodness that I need to be laboring for? And of course, he unpacks this. 9 through 12 is, it's interesting to read this, and he talks about the rewards of community, the thing that this loner who's laboring only for himself completely misses is that if he falls, there's no one there to help him. And I think about the number of people that live alone, and they have these little buzzers that they can press, and someone will come to help them. It's odd and interesting that it's a stranger that comes to help them. There's something really fouled up in the modern world, the way that we've worked it. And in some ways, I think that our greed, envy, efficiency, all these things have worked together so that the possibility of living without any other person except in an emergency is actually there. It's possible for people to live watching television, talking on the telephone, getting their mail, and never seeing another human being. This is a grave misfortune. There's a treasure that is missed with a lack of community. That's what he's saying, because community is a wonderful blessing. And then there's this mysterious statement at the end of this. He talks about the other things. If you fall, you have someone to help you up. You have someone to keep you warm when you sleep. And there's safety in numbers, so if there's danger, a community will protect each other, and people in a family or marriage, whatever. And then he makes this statement, which kind of sums it up, but instead of twos, it's a threefold cord. If you've ever done any rock or mountain climbing, you know what gold line is, and it's a threefold cord. That's a standard in the rope-making business, as I understand it. Because there's a strength in that threefold cord. It's all intertwined and wrapped, and there's tremendous strength in that. It's not two, not one, it's not four, it's three. A three-legged stool is a very stable kind of a stool. And so there is, I think, here perhaps the hint of eternity in that metaphor. And, of course, every marriage counselor or premarital counseling, we always say that there are three now that are involved in the relationship. There's the man, the woman, and then their God. And that is the threefold cord which brings strength. But clearly, whether that metaphor is meant by the author for that purpose or not, the whole of this thing of saying there's a better thing, Better than being alone is to have the blessings of community. But that won't save you from sin and death. And it won't give you an answer to the oppression and the envy that surrounds you. So then he moves on to a fourth, it's the fourth panel within the two panels. There are actually two panels here that have that verse 7 in the center of it. So we're looking out of the 7 at panels 3 and 4. And now the second part of panel 4 is verses 13 to 16. Better to be young and wise than old and forgotten. There are 7 ways you could say this, and I tried them all, but it's hard to sum up these verses. And it's a little bit mysterious. The commentators really don't fully agree on what's actually being said here. And I don't think we can be absolutely certain, except that the things we can say, I will tell you. It's better to be poor and wise. And the word poor here, incidentally, doesn't mean no money. It means a commoner as compared to royalty. A common, wise young person is better than an old royal person, a king, who's a fool. And what's interesting is his foolishness is exhibited in this fact. He no longer receives advice. We were just saying the other night that President Reagan was a great president. Whatever you think of his politics or his party is irrelevant, but he was a great president because he knew how to take advice. He sought the best advice in foreign policy. And then he made his decision, but he always sought good advice, and it's the reason that kings and rulers, presidents, succeed if they seek good advice. The old king has not succeeded. Now, it may be that what's being said here, and the Hebrew is difficult here because of several pronouns that just, you don't know what they go with. Are there two people here, three people, one person? We don't know. But it may be that this commoner, this wise young commoner becomes a king and then becomes a fool because he gets old and lazy. Or it may be that we're talking about two different people, one who becomes a king and gets the acclaim of the people. He comes from the common stock. And then there's the other person who is already of royalty. He is a king and he becomes foolish because he takes his royalty for granted. You know what? It doesn't matter whichever way you come out. Because, you know, after we consider those things, we might be thinking, well, yes, boy, wouldn't it be great? This success story is like no other in literature, where the poor person comes out of obscurity and poverty, overcoming obstacles, and becomes the king. Every American can become president if you want. It's the kind of thing that we love. And it has certainly a certain value at a certain level in our culture. But this is how the writer of Ecclesiastes ends. After the success story, he says, now there's no end of all the people over whom he was made king, so he has this great kingdom, yet those who come after will not rejoice in him. And for either one of two reasons, either he loses their loyalty or he dies. And we don't know. It doesn't really say clearly. But how does he end? He says, surely this also is vanity and grasping for wind. How much do you know about Nebuchadnezzar apart from what's in the Bible? How much do you know about any of the pharaohs of Egypt unless you are an Egyptologist? How much do you actually remember even about President Ronald Reagan or Dwight D. Eisenhower or Governor Benson? Not much. We forget even the great, and those who are less than great are completely forgotten. And that's his message here. This is also out of whack, grasping for wind. Grasping for wind, it ends up with emptiness. And so he's saying, yes, don't be a cynic. There are awful things going on in the world that frustrate our labors and make us wonder if it's worth it at all. And then there are good things. There is community. There is rejoicing in labor, which is legitimate. That's a message throughout the book. We rejoice in our labor. And notice, going back now to verse 22 of the first of chapter 3, he says, for who, rejoice in your work. This is your lot or heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? So he's saying in the immediate present, it's legitimate to enjoy the blessings that God gives you. But these are betters. They are not the best. And of course, he doesn't answer in the text what the best is. He will, actually next time, as we look at 5, 1 through 7, at the end of verse 7, he says, but fear God. Fear God. And we'll see the profound revelation of Jesus Christ that actually occurs in those 7 verses. But then listen to this. Listen to what Paul says. In a world in Philippi, which was a great trade center, one of the great colonies of ancient Rome, I'm sure there was loads of oppression, loads of envy, loads of the kinds of things that the writer of Ecclesiastes observed. But now we find the best. The better is okay. It will carry us along in this fallen world, both the believer and the unbeliever. But the best saves us. The best connects us with heaven. And the best enables us to endure in a way that the unbeliever can never really know. And so look what he says. He says, be anxious for nothing. First in verse 4, rejoice in the Lord. Yeah, rejoice in your work. That's good. But that changes from day to day. Rejoice in the Lord. Always, he says. There's no end of rejoicing because Jesus is the same as your Redeemer enthroned in heaven, as your Savior forever and ever, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And then he goes on and says, let your gentleness be known to all men. Why? The Lord is at hand. This fallen history that's out of whack is going to come to an end. And then be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And then, not just a handful of quietness, that's a good thing in its place, but hear now the peace of God, which goes beyond understanding. That will guard your hearts in and minds in and through Christ Jesus. That is the best. And that's what the writer of Ecclesiastes is pointing to. And it's really what the whole Bible is pointing to. And so, brothers and sisters, we live in the same world that the writer of Ecclesiastes lived in, that Q lived in. We live in that same fallen condition. It's a mixture of blessings and cursings, of good things and bad. But the good things are only betters. They are not the best. Christ, he connects us with the best, with eternity. And that's where our hope, that's where our ultimate peace will come from, and there alone. And may it be so in the week that we labor in and have begun in worship.